The following program deals with military and veteran issues. All comments and opinions expressed on this show are those who made them. They do not reflect the opinions of the Church of Satan or Radio Free Satan. So on with the show.
Welcome to the official Infernal Legion podcast. I'm your host, Reverend Jeff Bowling, the commander of the Infernal Legion, and joining me, as always, is my lovable and furry co-host, Reverend Dwayne Burns, the VSO of the Infernal Legion. Dwayne, how the hell are you, brother?
I'm doing good, brother. Legs are healing.
You sound a lot better than last time, and last time was only about a week ago, so that's a good sign, man.
I hurt like hell from the thunderstorms that went through last night, but all in all, I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah, like, I don't think a lot of people out there, I don't think, know that we both live in the same state and not that far away from each other. We're lucky to have survived a couple nights ago as the tornadoes ripped through here. No, really, it didn't touch down in either of our cities, but it was pretty hairy there for a minute. I've never heard the siren go off and just say, take shelter immediately. It's always like, oh, there's a watch. Keep an eye out. Oh, now there's a warning. But the sirens came on and they just said, take shelter immediately. Well, this episode is a very special Wicked Warrior episode. We have one of our newest members of the Infernal Legion is going to be joining us a little bit later on to tell her story about her time in the United States Navy and a surprising way of finding out about Satanism that will shock some of you. But before we get into that, I want to real quick address what everyone is talking about in the media right now. And that is the United States Military Academy at West Point has changed their mission statement. They have removed their motto, duty, honor, country, and replaced it with the words Army values. I'm not really sure why everyone's up in arms over this. So, Dwayne, maybe you can help me out a little bit. But their motto is still posted everywhere around the campus. What happened here is that some dumbass general wanted to pin on an extra star, so he created a legacy for his OER by swapping out some words in the official mission statement. If you listened to the last episode of the Infernal Legion podcast, you heard us go through the Army values: loyalty, duty, respect, selfless service, honor, integrity, and personal courage. You know how those apply to Satanism. You also know how often the word country pops up in the definitions for those different values. So I really think everyone's freaking out over nothing. You with me on that, Dwayne?
I'm with you. I'm tracking.
Just another thing that they're blowing out of proportion for apparently no good damn reason.
Extra star.
Right. Well, yeah, to get the extra star. That's right. All right, so we're going to take a quick break because, like I said, this is a Wicked Warrior episode, and this episode belongs to our very special guest, Kimberly Campos, who will be joining us in just a few minutes. So stay tuned right here on the official Infernal Legion podcast.
Welcome to the Metro. Your host, Reverend Jeff Ivins, brings you a weekly time trip back to the 1980s, with songs from the decade of decadence, only on Radio Free Satan. Hail Satan.
I'm tired of listening to you talking around. Twist and roll and make me think you're straight down the line. How you doing?
This episode is brought to you by The Warlock Emporium. The Warlock Emporium is creating bespoke items for the chosen few. The Warlock Emporium is the only authorized seller of items bearing the Warlock Sigil, created by Magister Dr. Robert Johnson, author of The Satanic Warlock. The Warlock Emporium is now offering a 15% military discount. Visit thewarlockemporium.com for more information.
Welcome back to the official Infernal Legion podcast, and I think it's about time to introduce our guest. So without further ado, please welcome one of the newest members of the Infernal Legion, Ms. Kimberly Campos is in the house. Kim, how are you?
I'm good. Hello, everybody.
All right. Now, Kim has a very interesting story, and we're going to go through that story. But as we always do, we're going to start with learning why anyone would choose to join the United States Navy. So, Kim, I'm going to turn it over to you. You're a fresh-faced young gal, fresh out of high school, and you decide to raise your right hand and take the oath of enlistment.
Why'd you do it? What happened?
I hated school. That's really the bottom line. I did not want to go to college. I basically skipped every day of my senior year, so I was like, yeah, I got to do something, and I don't want to stay home. I want to get out of South Florida. My friends are joining the Navy. I'll just join the Navy. So my summer going into my senior year, I went to the recruiting office, and I joined, and I was in debt for 364 days, and then 3 days after graduation, I was off to boot camp. And best decision I ever made, you know? It, like, switches you, flips the switch, as they say, and makes you kind of grow up real fast. So, I'm glad I did it.
It's certainly a trial by fire, or water, I guess, in your case.
Oh, yeah.
You said all your friends are joining the Navy, so that's why you chose the Navy. Is that the only reason, or was there, like, special bonuses or programs with the Navy that made it stand out over, say, the Air Force or the Army or the Marine Corps?
No, at first I was going to do Marine Corps. And then when I went, this was in 96 when I was deciding whether, you know, what branch to go into. So I went to the recruiting office, the Marine Corps, and I had really long hair. And, you know, we're vain at 17. I mean, I guess I'm still vain now, but I was like, wait, the Navy doesn't have to cut their hair, but the Marine Corps does? Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye. And I went to the Navy office, and that's what happened. And then, lo and behold, I get on the bus to go to boot camp, and the first thing they said, and all you girls, I thought you weren't going to have to cut your hair. Guess what? And I was so bitched. I was devastated. It was so stupid, but, you know, it's the little things that, you know.
Yeah, you can't back out at that point. You've already signed
the
paperwork.
Exactly. What am I going to do? So, yeah, that's why I didn't join any of the other branches. I didn't want to cut my hair.
That's a perfectly reasonable answer, especially for a Satanist.
Exactly. That should have been my first clue right there, right?
Before we get into boot camp, because all the best stories come from boot camp, did you pick your job in the Navy beforehand, or was it assigned to you during boot camp?
I picked it before. I picked it when I went to MEPS, and I wanted to be a corpsman because I knew I wanted to do medic stuff for the rest of my life. However, they didn't have any openings, so I was kind of forced between two jobs, and I just picked the lesser of the evils, I guess, but I ended up loving my job. It was great.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, I was lucky to have picked and not gone undesignated. Thank goodness.
Not end up as a bosun mate.
Exactly. No thanks.
All right, so let's talk about boot camp. Did you go to Great Lakes or did you go somewhere else?
I did. I went to Great Lakes in June, and we were still wearing coats. Like, it was freezing. Yeah. And I don't know if that's, like, because I'm a South Florida girl or, you know, but it was cold. So
no, I was born in Kenosha, Kim.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you've got two seasons up there, winter and the 4th of July.
Yeah, I think that's just the Chicago thing. It's always cold.
Yeah, exactly. And I wasn't ready. You know, I'm like, what is this? I wear a jacket. What? But yeah, June of 97. Crazy.
So as anyone who's been through boot camp, basic training, or whatever variation thereof, mm-hmm. it's obviously a shocking wake-up call. Mm-hmm. So tell me about the wake-up call. How did it go down for you?
I think I tried to be prepared, you know, because I was in delayed entry program for almost a full year. So I had a lot of that kind of background. But getting there and having to carry heavy things and, you know, just stupid, like wearing boots and then my feet hurt and, you know, cutting my hair. I was crying like a baby. Just, you know, ridiculous. Looking back at it, it's ridiculous. But, yeah, it was just a wake-up call because you learn it's not always all about you, even though it is, but it isn't. Like, you have to be a team. And that was a huge thing for me, is learning how to not focus on myself and focus on others too, to get through the hell, you know, that is boot camp. Even though the Navy boot camp is nowhere near as bad as, you know, Army or Marine Corps, but It was still hell for me.
Yeah, well, I think anybody in that position coming from, especially, you know, the younger ones coming from high school going in, it's not easy no matter which branch you go into. Even the Coast Guard is going to be difficult because most people who come in are coming from a they're not necessarily fat bodies or whatever, but they're coming from a pretty sedentary lifestyle.
Absolutely.
And then even if they played sports, it's a sedentary lifestyle compared to the military.
Absolutely.
So any boot camp, any basic training is going to be physically shocking. And, of course, the mental aspect. They always say that mass punishment is ineffective.
Yeah.
I disagree, at least in boot camp.
Well.
I think it's very effective.
Very. Yes, absolutely.
What is the process for the Navy? We've had a couple of Navy vets on. I don't think I've ever actually asked this question. Do you guys have a, like in the Army, we call it the shark attack. The Marine Corps has a similar thing where they stand on the footprints and then they get swarmed by drill instructors. Is there a process like that for the Navy, or is it kind of straightforward, move to this building, now move to this building, now we're training?
It's pretty straightforward. I mean, it's, you know, and for me, I was in a performance division because they were called 900 divisions. I don't know if they exist anymore now, but it was those of us who, like, played instruments or, you know, had some kind of, like, artsy-fartsy sort of background. And we scored, like, higher on the ASVAB, apparently, which, I mean, I didn't do that great. Like, I'm no genius by any means, you know? But, yeah, so we just did, for our pass and review, were the ones, like, that were in the band or did, you know, our drill stuff or state flags, all that. So we had it a little different because for our, I guess what you would call, what did you call it, Shark Week?
Shark Attack.
Ours was just learning how to do pass and review. So, okay.
So there's a lot of formalized stuff, not a lot of violent stuff.
No, not really. The worst we got was the gas chamber, which I think we all kind of
everyone goes to at some point.
But yeah, other than that, it was, looking back, it was easy. You know, there I was like, oh my gosh, I can't do it.
Well, of course, you got a bald head and everything.
Exactly.
The firefighting to me would seem like it'd be a little intense.
It's fun. I mean, yes.
We don't do firefighting, so.
Yeah, I did. On the ship, so for sure. I'm glad we had that in boot camp. But yeah, it was a kind of, not a free for all, but it was very easy comparatively to other branches.
So what did it feel like on graduation day? What was going through your mind as you were walking across the stage or however you guys do it?
I felt really proud, you know, especially as a female because, you know, in the 90s, females weren't in for that long prior to my time, so I just felt really happy, like, I did this, you know, the lazy, skipping school almost every day, like, just so I could sleep, because I didn't feel like getting up and going to school, like, I didn't even do anything bad, I just didn't want to.
You were just lazy.
Yeah, my best friend, whose house I'm in right now, I'm like, hey, you want to go get our hair done? She's like, hell yeah, and so we would just get our hair done. Like, it was just so stupid. But, you know, I looked back and, like, I did this. Like, I made it. And I'm so proud of myself for that. And, yeah, I'm still proud, even to this day. Like, you know, I did it.
Awesome. So let's talk about, I believe in the Navy it's called Sea School. You were operational specialist or an operations specialist?
Operations specialist, yeah. And we go to A School for that. There are
A School, that's what it is. A School, sorry.
But that's kind of like a specialty, like after A school, you can go to a C school.
Gotcha.
Yeah, A school was great. I loved it. That was like the best time of my life.
Well, what was that process like? Were you still in the Great Lakes area for that, or did you go to another base? Or
I went to Virginia Beach.
Okay.
Damn that base. Is that bringing back some memories over there? So I was there, and oh my God, it was like, my first freedom out of high school. So, oh, did I live it up? If I could go back to those days, that age, and just redo it, yes. So good.
Wouldn't change anything. Do it the exact same way every time.
Exactly. Oh, gosh, it was great. Yeah, 10 out of 10.
So how long was your A school?
It was, let's see, I got there in August, and I left in November. So 3 months.
Okay, so not bad.
Mm-mm.
Operations specialist, what does that mean? What did you do?
Basically, we work with, like, radar. That's sort of, like, our main thing in the combat information center on the ships. Just tracking ships and aircraft and sometimes submarines, shooting missiles, you know, like, for me, I controlled aircraft. I was an air intercept controller. So fighter pilots, I'd, you know, tell them where to go and what to do and all that stuff. But other than that, like, out to sea, we had a fantastic job. You know, it was just busy because we're keeping the ship safe, basically. But in port, all we did was, like, sweep. And, you know, like, I did not sign up for this. Paint, you know? No, I want to ship things. I don't want to be painting. Yeah.
So, yeah, let's talk about that. So you graduate your A school, and you head to the fleet.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like being assigned to your first ship and then that ship leaving the port and heading out to sea? Like, were you terrified?
Yes and no. So I did a tour when I was in high school of a carrier that had come to pulled into Port Everglades. And the guy that was giving us the tour was like, you know, we could take, you know, 20 torpedoes and, like, still be afloat. And I was like, okay, I want to go on one of the big ones because if we go to war, I could be hit with 20 torpedoes and I'll be all right. You know, again, I'm like 16 at this time, so that stuff makes sense. But then when I got to my first ship, it was in the shipyards and it was an oiler, a Cimarron class oiler, and it was in dry dock. And I'm terrified of heights, like terrified of heights. So I get there, and the ship is, I mean, bigger than a carrier. It was huge up. I was like, I can't walk up there. Like, how am I going to get up there? I'm terrified of this. So I had to have people I didn't even know, like, bring my sea bag up and, like, help me get onto the ship. And then my first day, I was painting, literally. Like, I thought, I said, boy, I didn't go to school to paint. Like, what am I? Oh, we got to get the ship ready. You know, we're in the dry dock. That's what we do. I'm like, okay. So every day I'd go and I'd paint. And then, you know, I'm like, do we ever go out to sea? Like, what are we doing? And then finally we went out to sea and it was fantastic because it wasn't wartime. You know, right, my first deployment was, you know, we spent 2 weeks in Marseille, France. And then we would go to Rota. And then we would, you know, we were never out to sea. We were just partying. So that was, like, the best. Again, as, you know, an 18, 19-year-old, wow, what a way to live, you know, like going overseas and living the best life for free.
Yeah, and, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, not just for free, getting paid for it.
Exactly. Right?
Getting paid to travel. That's the only reason that I saw a lot of the world in the Army, but the only reason I ever regret not joining the Navy is that they see so much of the world constantly.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And then, you know, after that, that was really the only deployment I went on that was, like, a fun deployment. Everything after that was, you know, post 9/11. So, you know, everything was wartime and there was no more real, you know, fun after that. But deployment.
Well, let's talk about that. We've talked with a lot of people who were in either who joined after 9/11 or who were in when 9/11 went down. What was that like? How did that change the atmosphere of wherever you were at when 9/11 happened?
So I was in Virginia still, at Virginia Beach, and my ship was out of Norfolk. I was on a DDG at the time. It was brand new, guided missile destroyer. And, you know, the call came in, and I was actually on convalescent leave because I had my tonsils out, like, a week prior to that. So I couldn't go out to sea. But my boyfriend at the time was on the ship with me, and he's like, I'm leaving. We're going, you know, off the coast and just security changing. You know, before we used to just drive on the base, there was no issues. And then after 9/11, it was just like everything stopped, you know, and it was the same for the world, obviously. But, yeah, everything just stopped, and it was just a different military. It was like actual military at that time. It wasn't, you know, just fun and games. It was.
It's almost like a levee breaking moment, right? It's like the entire military functions to do one thing, and they haven't really been doing that thing. And then all of a sudden, it's time to do that thing.
Absolutely. Yes. And I loved it. I mean, I was like, and then, you know, the 20 torpedoes that could hit me, like, that didn't matter anymore. It only right. mattered. Like, I want revenge on these people. Whoever did this to me, I want to do whatever I can to make it so they can't do this to anybody else ever again. And I didn't care about torpedoes or, you know, I was like, put me there and let's do this. Let's get our job done.
This episode is brought to you by Duffelblog. Read in the Pentagon and around the world, since 2012, Duffelblog has been the most trusted news source for the American military. Duffelblog is the first and only satire newsletter devoted to the United States military community. Visit Duffelblog.com for more information.
I want to talk about war and what that looks like on the ocean, especially for a largely land-based war. But before we get there, you'd mentioned that your first ship was dry docked.
Uh-huh.
I've always been curious, when a ship is in dry dock, and for those listening who don't know what that means, it means it's out of the water and usually being repaired. Do you still live on the ship, or is there barracks for you guys?
Yes. We did live on the ship, on the Platt. That was the ship I was on. Yeah, we lived on that still, but they also, I was also in another one where we were in the shipyards and it was dry dock, but they had like barges, like berthing barges for us to live on. So we were still in the water, but we lived separately, you know, from the ship. But yeah, dry dock, that doesn't mean that all the ships, you know, in dry dock you would live on, but we did.
Right. I guess it depends on why the ship is, right. what needs to be repaired on it.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's get back to warfare. 9/11 happens, the air changes, the energy changes, the military is all of a sudden, the op tempo is through the roof, and you head out on whatever your first deployment is post 9/11. What was your mission? What were you doing? Where were you going? And what was it like? Like, what were you actually engaged in?
So my first actual deployment after 9/11 was on a cruiser. Like I said, I was on a bunch of different ships, so we're kind of jumping all over, but that was the last ship I was on. And that deployment was 2007. Yeah, 2007. So it wasn't super, it was still post 9/11, but not close to that. And in this one, we were doing Somalian pirate operations.
Oh, the good stuff.
Oh, it was insanity. Like, we were anchored off the coast of Somalia with the motor vessel Faina, if you remember that. It was hijacked by pirates, and, like, the captain died, and it was basically Captain Phillips, the movie. It was kind of based off of that.
Oh, okay. It was that. That's the one that the SEAL sniped someone from the deck of another ship, right?
I don't know. Did they? Yeah, we did a lot of, there was a lot going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that we were anchored outside for 6 months. We didn't hit any ports. Just anchored, making sure that, you know, the crew stayed alive, and we were trying to get the pirates to, you know.
What's that kind of standoff like? Like, I mean, I think everyone's familiar with what a hostage situation on ground kind of looks like, but what does it look like when it's in the water?
I think it's more terrifying because you cannot go anywhere. I mean, obviously you're contained on land as well if you're in a hostage situation, but if you find a little bit of escape, you can go. On the water, where are you going to go? You're going to jump off and swim, you know?
Miles and miles, sure.
Yeah. You're not going anywhere, you know, and if you do, you're probably not going to make it. So let's be smart, let's stay on the boat and be nice and do what the pirates say and, you know, try to get out of this alive. But yeah, I still have like massive PTSD from that. And a lot of sure, people sure. they don't realize that the Navy, even though we're not, you know, on ground all the time, there are a lot of traumatic things that we can also go through.
Oh, certainly. Know? Yeah. It's still warfare. It's a different type of warfare, but it's still warfare.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And if anything, I've said this before, if anything, the Army and the Marine Corps get a lot of glory and glamour for, going toe to toe with the enemy on the ground. And the Air Force, obviously, everyone pictures them just blowing up buildings from far away and flying over and saving the day. But I've had young people come to me and say, like, oh, I want to join the military. What branch would you suggest? And I'm like, what do you want to do? You know, and if they're hell bent on going to war, they want to go see combat. They want to experience warfare. I always recommend either the Navy or the Coast Guard, because when we're at quote unquote peacetime, and we're sitting around with our thumbs up our asses painting rocks, you know, at some post stateside, the Navy and the Coast Guard is still out there. They're still dealing with pirates. They're still dealing with terrorists. They're still dealing with drugs coming into the country. They're constantly engaged with the enemy, even when the rest of the country doesn't know there is an enemy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very true. Yeah. And that's good that you kind of give them that point of view, because not everybody wants to be combat ground and, you know, infantry and like, no, thank you. But we do want to help the country, and we just don't want to be, you know, shooting somebody in the face while we're doing it. We'd rather push a button and watch our missile go.
Dwayne and I, being old surly soldiers, we know what you're really saying. It's that you guys are smarter than us. And we accept that. We accept that.
I always tell my boyfriend, I'm like, we can all talk mad shit about each other. But the second an outsider comes in and like starts talking about one of the branches, I'm like, who?
Oh yeah, no, it's a no-go. Watch out. Yeah. And they always love to copy our jokes, you know. So if we're calling Marine, like if Dwayne and I are calling a Marine a crayon eater, some random Joe Blow will be like, yeah, eat a box of Crayola. Shut the fuck up. This is not your battle.
Exactly. Stay out of this.
Let's talk about some fun stuff, because it is the Navy, right? Mm-hmm. The Navy is known for a few choice things, one of which is cursing. We talked about that before we started recording. There's a whole reason that the phrase is cuss like a sailor. But the other thing the Navy is known for, probably more than any other branch, is drinking.
Yes.
So tell me your favorite getting trashed story while you were a sailor.
So it was on my first deployment. I'd never drank before the Navy. I'd never smoked. I still haven't. But before all of that, we went to Italy. We were in Naples. And I was trying, we're at a bar, and I'm like, all the older sailors are like, here, try this. I'm like, okay. So, taking shots. And then before I knew it, I'm in the bathroom with my best friend and another person, and we're holding each other's hair up, throwing up all over the place, crawling back to our hotel room because we couldn't even stand up. People falling out of their racks, because, the racks are three high. So if you're on the top rack and you're drunk, you think you're going to crawl down? No. So,
they're not like full-size beds.
It's like little
tiny bunks.
Oh, my gosh. It's ridiculous. Even for small people, it's like... So, yeah, people would just boom in the middle of the night. You're like, oh, come on. Come on. Now I got to get up and try to help you, you drunk ass, even though I'm drunk too. It's fine. But just, I think, experimenting with alcohol. And it is like, we would have beer on the pier. Like if we couldn't go out into town somewhere where we pulled in, people wanted to drink so bad, they would just order beer and we would just drink on, right outside of the ship. Or we'd have beer on the fantail sometimes on the flight deck, just every once in a while they would have that. It's so stupid when you think about it. It is. I mean, Navy cursing and drinking, for sure.
Yeah, cursing, drinking, and of course the third big one that this is one that, just like drinking and cursing, kind of goes all over the military, but the Navy is very particular about it. Tattoos.
Yes.
What was your first sailor tattoo?
Do you know?
If you have any.
I have tattoos, I do, but no sailor ones.
Really?
Crazy, right? Yeah.
That's shocking.
Yeah. The only one I have, I mean, I do have one that kind of resembles, I got it when I was in the Navy, but it's a koi fish and it's trapped in seaweed. And for me, that was kind of like my, like I was the fish and I was like trapped in the Navy. I was trapped out to sea and I couldn't escape. So that was not really a sailor tattoo, but.
Yeah, I'd say that counts. It's not one of the traditional ones, but I'd say it counts.
Yeah, but then, you know, my ex-husband, he, like, every Sailor Jerry tattoo that you could possibly think of, he had all over himself, hold fast, and, you know, like, all the boatswain mate, he was a boatswain mate. That's why I laughed. Wow. Said that.
That's also probably why you had so many tattoos.
Why? Yes, it's like tradition for sure. Yes.
I was actually always curious about that because the Navy, and we've talked about it on the show before, the Navy has gone back and forth with their tattoo regulations.
Yes.
But one of the big traditions in the Navy is not just getting tattooed for every little thing that you do, but specifically hand tattoos. You mentioned like hold fast across the knuckles. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of shellbacks get the turtle on their wrist or on the top of their hand.
Yep.
Do they just do that even if it's out of regs, or do they wait till they get out if it's out of regulation?
A lot of people just wait, but now I want to say it was like 2016 maybe that the Navy changed the regs where you can have below the sleeve. So okay. People started going crazy at that point because we were all, you know, stuck with not being able to get the tattoos that we wanted.
Right.
So, yeah, people just went absolutely nuts. But if you had them while, like, if you got a new one when that reg wasn't authorized, then they would kick you out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, which that sounds about right.
Ridiculous.
They're dumb like that.
Like,
it's one of those things. Why not embrace it, right? It's
absolutely
already associated with sailors. Yeah, I mean, you just heard me interviewing you, assuming you had some Navy tattoos, and you did, so I wasn't wrong. But I mean, if it's that linked to your service, you might as well just embrace it and let them have it.
Absolutely.
You know? If nothing else, it makes them look better. It makes them look more like the stereotypical sailor.
Agreed. 100%.
So I mentioned the shellback. What kind of fun little orders were you inducted into? Were you blue nose shellback, golden shellback, all those things? Like, which ones are you a part of?
I am a golden shellback. We did the prime meridian and equator cross.
Nice.
So that's what we call the golden shellback. And it was right off the, like, around Seychelles area. And that was right after we left the pirates.
So you get a big party to celebrate
exactly
what you just went through.
All right, everybody, here we go. Let's go. We're going to do this. And then we ended up going back to the pirates, but we all still.
But you have blown off some steam, so you were good.
Exactly. We got
all right. So there's people out there that the last time this story was told on this podcast was when our communications officer, Reverend Jeff Ivins, told his story about getting his shell back. It's been a minute is what I'm trying to say here. It's been a couple years, actually.
Okay.
So, Kim, please tell us about the golden shell back ceremony.
All right. So we are basically tortured for King Neptune. Basically, and so you have a royal court, and this royal court, you have to do everything they say. And basically what that entails, I was lucky-ish that it happened, like, where, you know, we had, like, distress cards, like, oh, no, you're hurting my feelings, don't do this, don't, no hazing, oh, no.
You had stress cards for the shellback ceremony.
It was so stupid. So, like, instead of, like, eating rotten eggs, you know, like, they used to just keep all the trash in the trash, like, in the kitchen, in the galley, they would put all of the old food and save it for we were crossing the equator. So instead of doing that, they would make fresh eggs and, like, just dye them to look nasty, you know, and we'd have to eat them off the non-skid, which, if you don't know what non-skid is, it's like sandpaper that if you rub your finger across it, you know, you're gonna bleed. Yeah, so we would have to eat it off there, crawl around, skin up our hands and knees, eat olives out of, like, the fattest man's belly button on the ship.
That's the one that always got me.
Laying on my back like a flipped over turtle and singing the SpongeBob SquarePants song to the queen of I can't remember the name, queen of something or other. Lay down and sing SpongeBob. Aye, aye, Captain. And we're just, you know. Yeah, but it was fun. It was a. I'm glad I got to do it. I still have my certificate.
I was going to ask next. Did you get do you get a certificate for that, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's a pretty nice one, and it just, you know, it's very piratey and Neptune-y. Just saying, like, all you who, you know, like, mate, it's a golden shell back. Like, yay!
Now, I've often wondered, because, so you were a golden shell back. I've often wondered if someone who was just a normal shellback crossed the equator and then ended up at another time doing the Prime Meridian, would they have to re-go through the ceremony?
No. Okay. So that's the thing. You have the polywogs and the shellbacks. So if you haven't done the ceremony before, you're a polywog. And we are the ones who have to crawl around and, you know, do all the stupid things. And then the shellbacks are the ones who make the polywogs do all of the things as, you know, kind of like a rite of passage. So if you've already done it, it's the same kind of, you know, gotcha. Ceremony, I guess you can say. I mean, if you wanted to participate, I guess you could, but I don't know why anybody would
choose to do it.
But back in the day, like my first ship, I got there after they got back from their first deployment, but they would do a lot of flogging, like take the fire hoses and cut them and like beat each other and like, oh, it was, I'm glad I didn't have to go through that.
It was, but, there is, for anyone who's interested in it. So first of all, I find military ritual to be fascinating. And we've talked about this on the show, Dwayne and I have, because it very much is, it reaffirms your, much like ritual and Satanism reaffirms ideals and your goals in life, ritual in the military reaffirms your commitment to the military. So it's a very fascinating thing. And the Navy particularly is, outside of maybe the balls that the other branches do, the Navy's little shellbacks, blue noses, and all the other things are some of the most potent rituals in the military.
Absolutely.
So it's a fascinating, and I always, if I have a sailor on, I always want to hear about those stories because they're just so interesting. But for anyone who hasn't seen it, there are videos on YouTube of shellback ceremonies now going all the way back to the 1950s, I think. And some of them are brutal. So I highly recommend that you guys go watch those videos and see what we're talking about here.
Absolutely. Yes.
So you dealt with the pirates. Mm-hmm. You got your shell back. You've been on several ships. How many ships were you on while you were in?
I was on 4 ships. And then I was in Japan for 3 years and then back in Virginia. Yeah. Nice. So most of it was sea time.
Which is, I mean, if you're going to join the Navy, you might as well, right?
Right? And then we do it, and we get on the ship, and like, oh, I can't wait to go to shore duty. I can't stand being out to sea. And then you get to shore, and you're like, oh, I want to go back to the sea. This shore duty's crap.
What was the longest you were out at sea without seeing another ship on the ocean? Because the ocean is a bit, I don't think people understand how big the ocean is.
Massive. Like,
even when a fleet is sailing together, you may not see the other ship.
Correct.
So what was the longest you were out there without seeing another ship, without engaging with anyone?
A lot of the times on the oiler, we engaged all the time because we were always refueling.
Refuel, yeah, that makes sense.
So we were always, but then when we're on a non-refueling ship, we still have to have some kind of contact with an oiler because, you know, obviously we're not getting fuel if we're not pulling in somewhere. So we did a lot of unreps, but most of the time, I think the longest I'd say is probably like a month of not having. And that's also like if we don't see another ship, we're not getting stores, we're not getting fresh food, we're not all the things we have on the ship are that's it. That's what we have. And there'll be days, you know, we got you got some bread and some moldy apples, like, enjoy.
Hey, if the submarines can do it, you guys can do it.
Exactly. We have way more storage than they do. So, yeah, I'd say about a month, but, like, with the pirates, like, we were anchored. That deployment was almost 10 months long, and at least 6-7 months of that was stagnant, anchored, just moving.
But it's kind of, I imagine, and maybe I'm wrong, so please correct me if I'm wrong. I imagine in a situation like that, as high as the op tempo is, as stressful as it is, you know that you're not alone, right? Like your ship is there, the pirates are there, but there's other boats in the area. There's, I'm sure, submarines underneath. There's planes flying all the time. So you know you're not alone in that situation.
Correct. Yeah, we always, and that's what I kind of loved about my job is I knew where everybody was in our,
because that was your whole thing.
Right. Even if they were far away, like, I knew how far away, and I knew who was where and what they were doing, you know, and I was very lucky to be in that. But there was people who were, like, barbers. They were like, I haven't seen anybody. Like, sorry. Right. Not alone. Just know that.
All right. So you had, it sounds like, a very eventful and fun, if at times stressful, career. 14 years you spent in the Navy. What happened? Why'd you separate? Why didn't you go for the full 20?
That's kind of what we were talking about earlier with, I was in E6, and that was on the pirate cruise, is what I like to call it.
Oh, okay.
So I was in E6, and then, I was the leading petty officer in charge of, you know, the junior people in my division, and they were getting into trouble doing things they weren't supposed to be doing, and so who takes the fall?
No.
That.
Sailors getting in trouble? No.
I know. Like, you know, my two young they were seamen, OSSNs, two, were sleeping with, like, 15 other people on the ship.
Oh, damn.
And, you know, like, I didn't know it was 15 people. I just knew they, like, had a little boo. Like, do you, boo? It doesn't work. Like, I don't give a shit what you're doing. You know, just don't do it on the boat. You can do it off the boat. Don't do it on the boat. And then it got back that it ended up being this whole investigation of, they found like 18 people total, and I got brought in on that because I was in charge and I knew about it.
I see, yeah.
But I didn't do anything to stop them. So then I got to be an E5. Hooray. So at 14 years, I hit my higher tenure, and so I had to get out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
They busted you?
They busted me. Yep.
They busted her because her semen were fucking.
That's right. Yep. It was unreal. I was devastated. Like, oh my gosh, I was devastated. And then I was like, fuck the Navy. Fuck all
right.
The on this ship. Right. Oh, I hate you.
All right. So you basically aged out is essentially what that means. You were too low of a rank for the time in service. So they shifted you on out, which, I mean, it happens. It happens in every branch. So you get out of the Navy. What's your move now? Because it sounds like you weren't planning to get out of the Navy.
Correct.
So what did you do immediately afterwards? Did you try to find civilian employment? Did you use your benefits to go to school? Like,
both. So okay. I got very lucky. When I got orders, after I got busted down, I got sent to NAS Oceana, into the command security manager for NAS Oceana. And I just worked in her office. And I was very good at it. I mean, we're smart, you know? Like, we catch on. So she was like, and you're getting out. She's like, I'm going to have a position for a civilian. Do you want to work here as a civilian? Yeah, I would love that. So I got out in June of 2011, and then August 1st of 2011, I started as a civilian in the same position. So
it's always nice when that works out, isn't it?
Yeah, it was great. I was so lucky. I was like, oh my gosh, yes, yes. So I worked there for a few years, and then I was like, you know what? I want to be a nurse. Like, I've always wanted to work in
medical. What you wanted to do when you enlisted, yeah.
Yep. So I went to nursing school. And I stopped working at the office, went to nursing school, and I've been a nurse.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Finally.
So, looking back, 14 amazing years in the Navy, would you do it all over again?
Absolutely. Yep.
Well, that's what we love to hear. So, let's take a quick break. Here's some messages from Radio Free Satan. And when we come back, we'll talk about that dreaded S word, because Miss Kim here has a very interesting story relating to Satanism. Stay tuned right here on the official Infernal Legion podcast.
This is Reverend Gene, the host of Vox Satane, exclusively on Radio Free Satan. Join me every week as we indulge in the classical side of music spanning the past 1,000 years. Vox Satane has already featured over 700 composers covering medieval, baroque, classical, romantic, and contemporary music, including chant, choral, opera, keyboard, and orchestral music, with composers ranging from Gluck to Gilmore, Bach to Bellavance, Talis to Taverner, and Paganini to Pärt. Get your weekly recommended dose of classical music right here on Vox Satane, only on Radio Free Satan, with me, Reverend Gene. Hail Satan!
Well, man, it is now official.
The Shit Kickin' Road Show, the finest in rockabilly, psychobilly, vintage country, swamp rock, surf rock, doo-wop, this potpourri of madness. The Shit Kickin' Road Show, Radio Free, goddamn Satan. I'm Clint Mephisto, coming at you from the Double Cross Ranch. Booze in one hand, microphone on the other, swamp thing on the telly, and the good tunes in front of me here at the computer. The Shit Kickin' Road Show, Radio Free Satan.
Damn! You will excuse me, won't you? Well, thank you very much.
Why start your mornings early when you can sleep in late and wake up later to a freshly brewed cup of Radio Free Satan? Radio Free Satan is infernally roasted, with a complex taste to suit your indulgence. It's sinful, that's why it tastes great. So pour yourself another helping of this podcast and others at RadioFreeSatan.com.
In 1966, Anton LaVey created the Church of Satan, marking the beginning of the Age of Fire and Year One Anno Satanas. In 1969, he published The Satanic Bible, codifying Satanism as a religion, the first time it's been done in human history.
In the name of Satan, ruler of the earth, king of hell, come forth from the pit, bestow the blessings of hell upon us. For we are your children, and we invoke thee this night.
In 2001, I was appointed High Priest of the Church of Satan. In 2007, I published the Satanic Scriptures, further defining and expanding on Satanic philosophy and greater magic ritual.
Hail Satan, full of might!
Hail Satan, full of might!
Our allegiance is with thee!
Our allegiance is with thee!
Cursed are they!
Cursed are they!
The God adorers!
The God adorers!
And cursed are the worshippers!
And cursed are the worshippers!
Of the Nazarene eunuch!
Of the Nazarene eunuch!
For the past 50 years, the Church of Satan has stood as the sole organization to define and defend Satanism as a religion. And though pretenders to the infernal throne have come and gone, we have stood the test of time and will into the future. Visit churchofsatan.com for more information and read the Satanic Bible and the Satanic Scriptures. Knowledge is the solution for ignorance. Hail Satan!
Hail Satan!
Hail Satan!
Welcome back to the official Infernal Legion podcast. We are sitting down with our wicked warrior, Kimberly Campos, and I thought it was appropriate to play that ad before we get into this next topic, because we live in strange times, my friends. When I first discovered Satanism, it was a pretty straightforward process. There was a book, you found the book, you read the book, and then eventually you went and joined the Church of Satan. Nowadays, with online communication and the plethora of pretenders to the throne, it's not quite as straightforward a process as you might think it would be. Why am I saying all this? Well, our dear friend Kim here used to be a member of one of these groups, that we tend to not give a lot of airtime to on the show for obvious reasons. But I'm going to let Kim tell you exactly how she ended up in that group and how she ended up taking that and discovering what true Satanism is. So, Kim, you were a member of the Satanic Temple.
Don't make me throw up. Yes, guilty as charged. I was, out of pure naivety. So, yeah, growing up, like I think most of us, Satanic Panic era, you know, Satan is evil and, you know, God is the only way and all the things. But I never kind of, you know, fit that mold. I feel like most of us that are Satanists also don't fit that mold.
Right.
So growing up, I always kind of shied away from anything satanic because it was scary to me. You know, I don't want to go to hell. I don't want to do that. So my boyfriend, who is also a member of the Infernal Legion, he was talking to me and was like, I used to read the Satanic Bible. I'm like, why in the fuck would you do that? Like, that is an evil book. You can't do that. And he's like, do you know anything about it? I'm like, yeah, I know that it's evil because it's the devil trying to put shit in your brain and, like, you know. And he's like.
So the programming was in there a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. I was a product of that for sure. And so I was like, you know, let me do a little research. So I started doing a little research and I'm like, holy shit, it has nothing to do about the devil at all. It's about yourself. This is great. I'm like, this is who I've been my whole life, and I had no idea. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to make it official. I'm going to be an official Satanist. So I typed in the Google Satanism, and the first thing that popped up was the Satanic Temple. And I'm like, click. So I'm like, going through, and I'm like, oh, I just send them $25 and I get like a certificate, and like I'm a Satanist. I'm like, hooray! So I did it, and then I was so proud of myself.
Which should be a warning to everyone out there.
Absolutely. So I was so proud, and I called Tony and I was like, babe, guess what I just did? And he's like, what? I'm like, I'm a member of the Satanic Temple. And he was like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Yeah. I'm like, what do you mean what's wrong with me? Like, this is where I want to, you know, this is who I am. And he's like, are you sure? I'm going to need you to read this. And it was like TST versus Church of Satan differences. And then I saw all the Lucian Graves, like, wackadoodle shit. And I'm like, oh my God, this is the guy, this guy from Hail Satan? Like, that's the guy? Oh, no, 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 no. So I did a lot more research, and I immediately emailed TST and was like, please, I want no affiliation, made a mistake, I want nothing to do with you. And then I did my research, and, like, when I put my application for the Infernal Legion, I was like, I'm not a member of the Church of Satan, yes, because I don't feel worthy yet. Like, I'm getting there, but I don't feel like after my TST fumble that I'm
not worthy.
Exactly. And that's really how I felt. That's exactly how I felt. I was like, I understand if you don't want to accept me into this group because I'm not a member, but I'm getting there. Like, I'm ready.
I know it's basically what you said. You're like, look, I had this little fumble and I hope you don't hold it against me. And I am filling out and I think you even sent me a picture of your, like, filled out.
Yes.
Information for the Church of Satan.
Yes. Yep. And I'm glad because, you know, I feel like TST is in the process of just making a whole nother Satanic Panic. And
yeah.
Ain't nobody got time for that. Like, we're not out here trying to fix the world. We're out here trying to just live our best lives and, you know, stop making it about, it's like about him and about, no, 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 no. Let's not.
It's what Dougie wants.
So we often, a lot of us who are, I would say, publicly members of the Church of Satan, there's obviously, the Church of Satan is much like an iceberg. Because we don't require Satanists to be public with their affiliation, the people that you see or hear, in this case, are only a small percentage of the actual membership of the Church of Satan. However, a lot of us are online a lot because that's the way the world works now. And so we're constantly tangling and battling misinformation and things of that nature. And I think that, and one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, and I wanted you to talk about this, was because I think a lot of us lose sight of how the digital world works. Being elitist and believers in stratification, it's easy for us to say, oh, well, you get what you pay for, you fucking moron. But it's not as easy as it was when we found Satanism to right. follow that natural trajectory. For a lot of reasons. It's not anything the Church of Satan is doing wrong. Let me be very clear about that, because right. Dwayne and I are some of the people who have to go out there and do this, so we're definitely not doing it wrong.
Right.
But there's just so much information, and social media especially has given everyone a platform,
yes.
whether they deserve it or not.
Yes.
And so I think it's really valuable for Satanists to hear your story. And to know that, you know, you read the Satanic Bible, figured out what was going on, mm-hmm. and immediately disaffiliated, and are now your application is pending with the Church of Satan.
Yep.
And you did it the best way you can, given right. the information that you had.
Right.
Us agents and representatives need to keep that kind of stuff in mind and speak to people as if they're not absolute morons, unless they show themselves to right. be absolute morons.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, because I know it's very frowned upon, and we can come to the light and be like, oh, dumb mistake I made, you know? And I feel like if we acknowledge that and we're forthcoming with that, you know, at least we acknowledge we fucked up, you know?
Right.
Like, give us a little leeway. We're trying to be better. We're trying to do the right thing here.
Okay, so we got that out of the way. It wasn't so bad. We pulled that Band-Aid off, right?
That's right. That's right.
This episode is brought to you by Underworld Amusements. Since 2007, Underworld Amusements has been creating, producing, publishing, and distributing Curious Sundries and Callous Broadsides. From the Satanic Scriptures by Magus Peter H. Gilmore to Might is Right, the Authoritative Edition by Ragnar Redbeard, Underworld Amusements is your source for the most dangerous books ever written. Visit underworldamusements.com for more information.
Okay, so we talked about your journey through the Satanic Temple, and we've got that out of the way, and I think the message that we wanted to get out there is pretty clear to anyone listening. So let's talk about Satanism itself. You said that you had kind of had this Christian programming, especially from the Satanic Panic era, that was hardwired into you. And it was your boyfriend. Great guy, by the way. Great guy. I hope to have him on this show when he's able to. But he was the one that introduced you into what Satanism actually is. So talk to me about when you got your hands on a copy of the Satanic Bible and you started reading it. What were your first impressions? Were you nervous the whole time? Were you guilty the whole time? And when was the moment in the book where it clicked and you were like, oh, this is me?
Really, yes to all of those. I was nervous. I was just mesmerized. I'm not a stupid person by any means, but reading it in the way that Anton LaVey, like, just puts his words down on paper, I was like, what even am I reading right now? Like, this man is a genius. Just the way that everything was written and laid out. And then I was like, I don't think I'm smart enough to, like, grasp all of this stuff. This is a pretty, you know, this is deep. I don't know if I'm ready. And there were times when I would call Tony and I'd be like, babe, I need help. Like, can you try to walk me through, like, this is how I'm reading this. Can you tell me if you read it the same way? And we kind of worked through the Bible together in some ways. And it really, when did it just click? I read it a couple times,
mm-hmm.
you know, before I was like, this, yes, this is where I belong. Even though I knew it was where I belonged, like I said, I wasn't worthy. I didn't feel worthy.
Well, and you're still fighting that programming. You're still fighting that programming.
Yeah, you know. Absolutely. So I just want, you know, the entirety of the writings just clicked. Mm-hmm. You know, once I read it through the first time and had questions, obviously, I tried to do most of the research myself, as, you know, we should do. But
Study, not worship. Yeah.
Exactly. So I researched and I watched podcasts and listened to podcasts and I just did everything I could so I grasped it. And then I read it again and I was like, there it is. There it is. All of it. Vampires are a big one for me. That one really, like, it kind of woke me up a little bit.
Yeah, it's certainly something everyone, I think, at this point knows that Anton LaVey was, as any philosopher does, pulling a lot of sometimes maybe disparate religious and philosophical ideas and creating something new out of them. But psychic vampires, that was all him. That was, as far as I understand it, that he just noticed human behavior and he coined a term to put a name to what it was. I don't think Anton LaVey gets enough credit for essentially inventing the concept of the psychic vampire.
Yeah, and it is so true. If you have not read the Satanic Bible, if you read anything, read that part because it is.
Yeah, for sure. Even if you're not a Satanist, there is.
Yes.
For non-Satanists, who aren't scared of picking up a little $9 book. The chapter, the psychic vampire chapter, Not All Vampires Suck Blood, I think was the title of the chapter.
Yes.
It will give you some tips for dealing with those lot lice who are infesting your circus tent, as it were.
Absolutely. And it makes you realize too, if you are that, if you could be that, and I see it in myself sometimes. I think we all do, just being a negative Nancy and just like, why am I even, this is so stupid. Why am I being like this? Like,
that's an interesting perspective. It's like a wake up call. It mm-hmm. makes you remember that responsibility is paramount.
Absolutely.
Responsibility for yourself is paramount.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, I like the way you put that. Interesting. Okay. So you have your whole foray into the Satanic Temple. And obviously you're a bit nervous to reach out to us, you were a bit nervous, but to reach out to the broader Church of Satan itself, you were a bit nervous after having been in that group.
Yes.
What was the deciding factor? What was the thing that you're like, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to go ahead and join. I'm going to send in my stuff. Cause you just recently did that.
Yes. It's been probably like 2 weeks.
Yeah. So you're not going to hear back anytime soon, just so you know.
It'll be a hot minute. But in my head, I'm part of it, okay? That's
right. All that
matters. I did my part, and hopefully they loved me. No.
My wife's the same way. She is so worried that I'm going to get her in a room with Peter and Peggy, and they're going to start talking, and she's not going to understand what they're saying.
Terrifying.
You just can't feel that way.
No, you can't. Because, I mean, in every documentary, every interview, I mean, I don't look at that and feel like, oh, gosh. Like, I could never – I'm not worthy of that. I am worthy of being in their presence because they're amazing.
I wouldn't go so far as to call Magus Gilmore a big old teddy bear. Let's just say that he's a really genuine human being.
Right. That's all that matters to me, just being a part of something that is genuine. We are ourselves, and
right.
We are unapologetically ourselves. And we may not like the other person's part, but we are, I don't know. I'm not very eloquent when it comes to getting
That's fine.
My shit out there, but basically I'm proud to be almost considered part of the Church of Satan, and just, we're going to forget this ever happened. Episode.
We're going to immortalize it forever on the Church of Satan.
Will listen to this that found TST and maybe have the same reaction.
So let me we're a veterans organization, and obviously you're on here because you're a veteran. Now understanding the philosophy of Satanism, what it really is, obviously you discovered this after your service, mm-hmm. but looking back on your service now through the lens of a Satanist and actually understanding that lens, is there anything that you feel like may have been improved in your service had you discovered Satanism before that?
Yeah, I think I would have been much more true to myself because I did try to fit the mold of what the popular thing was you know, in the military. Like, I didn't, even though my whole life I grew up very, not spiritual per se, like, I still never really believed in heaven or hell. I just thought, like, the idea of Satan was terrifying. And if
right, yeah.
Hell, you know, like, that's petrifying. I think you just try to fit a mold so that you're not the outcast. And now, I don't care about being an outcast. I'm perfectly happy in my own skin and my beliefs, and I want it to be like that throughout service too. And the people that were like that were, you know, secretly I was like, wow, like, they're ballsy, like, this is fantastic, but I could never get there, you know. And I wanted to be myself, and I just never was.
Right. No, I understand that.
Yeah.
And there is it's one of the bedrock things that Satanism is all about, is discovering the power of true individualism. Being true to yourself is not just necessary for a healthy mind and a healthy life, but it's an extreme source of power. And you can always see, you can tell, whether you're at a bar or the grocery store or whatever, someone who is genuinely true to themselves, who is a legitimate outsider, and doesn't have any desire to be a part of the inside, they stand out in a palpable, almost energetic way.
Absolutely.
And sometimes, you know, those of us who are capable of that but haven't figured out how to do it yet need a little push in the right direction. And the Satanic Bible is an excellent push in that direction.
Excellent push. That is, great way to say that. It was an excellent push. It just makes you open your eyes and realize, like, wow, what have I been doing my whole life? You know, who even am I? This is who I've been trying to be, and I have permission to be that, you know?
Right. Yeah, we talked a little bit about your boyfriend. Like I said, I want to have him on at some point. I know he's got different responsibilities at the moment. But
yes.
I don't want to give too much away in case he does come on, or in case I shouldn't talk about it at all. But have you had the opportunity then, since you and your boyfriend are both Satanists and, for all intents and purposes now, both members of the Church of Satan, have you had the opportunity to experience or practice with satanic ritual?
Yes, powerful when you do that together. I mean, it's powerful on its own, but, you know, he lives further away from me, so we don't get to be close together very often.
Right.
But we do. That first ritual we did, neither one of us had ever experienced anything so powerful and just so, like, fulfilling. You just wow, it just opens everything. There's no words.
It's very similar to, like, if you're, you were Navy, so you probably didn't do a whole lot of land navigation. I remember in my land navigation course, looking at the map, and I had gone through all the classroom stuff on the map. But now I'm looking at the map, and it's like you're, you know, looking at a foreign language. And I remember the moment where I, like, figured out what that symbol represented, because I, like, looked up and right in front of me was that thing on the map. And I'm like, oh, okay. It's like almost like a Rosetta Stone type moment.
Yes.
And I find that ritual has that effect. If you're, you know, if you really have the ability to let yourself go and indulge in the ritual, there can be a path to exactly what it is that you're trying to get, but you just can't quite make the symbol on the map match up with whatever's there, and then bam.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, there's the trail.
Absolutely.
It's where that deer is hopping along, you know, or whatever.
That's exactly how it went. I mean, that's a great metaphor. Yeah, that's exactly how it went. It was just magical. Just magical. And, you know, ritual is different for everybody, obviously.
Of course,
but,
yeah.
You know, if you have, and I don't even know if love has to be, like, part of that, but if you have somebody who you are so connected to, and you both have the same values and belief systems and are wanting similar things, and you do this ritual together, it's just like the magic is quadrupled. It just, you know, like, oh man, it was just.
Yeah. Dr. LaVey talked about it in the, I believe in Satanic Rituals. He discusses what the purpose of group ritual and why it's so important. And he's done it in a few other places too. I just don't remember off the top of my head which books they were in. But yeah, there is, I mean, obviously, like you said, there is power to ritualizing by yourself. I do it pretty frequently, but there is, if you have a group of people who have the same, like you said, the same values, the same passions, and the same kind of goal, like they're all trying to get towards the same thing, having them all together and formalizing it is such a way to harness that all and shoot it out, much like the missiles you used to launch off the ship.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's amazing what you can do. You know, people just, they don't give it a chance. And, you know, if they just gave it a chance and really harness their own power, the things that they can accomplish, I mean, you know, just amazing, amazing. Everybody should do it, even if it's not satanic. You know, just ritual in general, just a ceremony of you and what you want.
I agree with that. Consciously ritualizing, I think, is it's one of the reasons why it was so important to Dr. LaVey and why he put it in. I've been beating this dead horse for a long time, but why about 2/3 of the Satanic Bible is magic? It wasn't necessarily because satanic magic is so different from any other form of ritual. But it's because ritual is necessary to the human animal, because we need that. That's why religion has had a stranglehold on our society for so long, because we have to have that ritual, that dogma, that ceremony. And so he invented a kind for our kind, and it works perfectly well. But yeah, if you're listening to this and you're not a Satanist, by all means, go find some form of ritualization that'll help empower you.
Yeah.
Well, Kevin, it's been fantastic.
So much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on, and thank you for having the balls to send that email, not knowing if you would be accepted.
Yeah, I was shocked, honestly. I mean, I think afterwards I was like, oh my gosh, really? I was like giddy. Yay!
But it's been absolutely great to have you here, and I'm sure that in, you know, 6 months, you'll hear back from the Church of Satan, and I'm sure you'll hear back in the affirmative, because you're a genuine human being.
Thank you.
As far as I'm concerned, you're through and through a Satanist. And let your story be a warning to those out there who don't know the pitfalls of modern discovery of Satan.
Yes.
I will, real quick, I'm just going to ask, even though I said I wasn't going to, I'm going to do it anyway. You submitted your registered membership application, but you're considering your active membership application.
Absolutely.
So what is your favorite joke?
So what is my favorite joke? Since I work in the medical field, I had, and you know, I think about it now, like I'm wondering if this man was a Satanist and I just didn't know. He asked me, you can be in my room if you tell me your favorite joke. And so I thought medical, and I said, what is the similarities between a puppy and a gynecologist?
Okay.
They both have a wet nose. And he busted out laughing, and I busted out laughing because I don't even know where the hell that came from. And even though it's not, you know, like the best joke in the world, there's funnier ones, but that one has meaning to me because, you know, it made me and this particular doctor, like, kind of bond, and I was always in his room then, and that made me happy. So that's fantastic. But now I wonder if I have to change that for my application.
Oh no, not at all. I'm sure that they'll hear this and laugh, and then months down the road, when they actually read your application, they'll just laugh again.
That's why I remember this.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for coming on. I'm looking forward to collaborating with you more in the Infernal Legion, and obviously helping you through whatever we need to with your veterans issues. Thank you for your service, and thank you for being on the show. So until we do it again, hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
There is a new veteran crisis hotline number. If you or a veteran you know are experiencing a crisis, please dial 988 and press 1. Once again, that is 988 and press 1 when prompted.